You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Down in the Valley by Jeff Wise. For better or for worse, he was committed to his escape plan. Job one was to get up through the soup and into clear air above. Once on top, he could get to the coast and then find a gap in the clouds to descend through. It would be like the Coachella trip all over again. If he handled it right, no one would ever know what he'd done. Zobayan held the Sikorsky in a climb and toggled the mic. His voice was unhurried, if a tad higher in pitch than before. And Sokal, for Helicopter 2EX, we're going to go ahead and start our climb to go above the layers, and we can stay with you here. He made it sound like he'd found a hole and was getting ready to start a legal climb. SoCal Approach had undergone a shift change, and a new controller was now on the frequency. 2EX, where are you? Just west of Van Nuys. The calmness of Zobayan's voice belied the peril of the situation. He hadn't prepared himself for getting into the clouds, and now he was behind the plane, reacting to the unfolding situation instead of anticipating what might happen. People thrust unexpectedly into dangerous situations react according to habit. If he'd been practicing the correct technique in those months since his IIMC training, he might have remembered to engage the autopilot and let it handle the climb. Instead, he flew the way he usually did, by hand. The risk of hand flying is that it's easy to become disoriented if you don't pay close attention to your instruments. As Zobayan climbed, he gradually began to bank the helicopter to the left. Then, catching himself, he corrected the error and brought the aircraft back toward level. Over at SoCal Approach, the new controller couldn't find Zobayan on his radar screen, so asked him to push a cockpit button that would make his tracking marker light up. Zobayan did so, and the controller spotted him. Were you requesting flight following? Yes, sir. The helicopter had now ascended some 500 feet and was more than halfway into its climb through the clouds. At this rate, Zobayan would be in the clear in about 15 seconds. But for whatever reason, he failed to stay focused on his artificial horizon. The helicopter began to lean to the left, first gently, then steeply. Unable to see the ground, Zobayan must have misinterpreted the cues his inner ear was giving. It felt like the aircraft was banking to the right, when it was actually turning to the left. The more he tried to correct it by shoving the stick to the left, the worse he made it. Soon he was in a steep bank. The controller asked where he intended to go. 2EX, where, say, intentions? By now, Zobayan had climbed 1,000 feet. The clouds surrounding him grew wispier. Brightness suffused them. He was nearly at the top of the clouds, nearly in the clear. We're climbing to 4,000. 9:45:19 a.m. Even as he spoke, the steepening bank was drawing the helicopter back into the clouds. The overcast grew darker once more. Though he didn't seem to realize it, Zobayan was not climbing, but descending, and with increasing speed. Ask the controller, and then what are you going to do when you get to altitude? No answer. 9:45 and 30 seconds a.m. Two mountain bikers were taking a break on the trail above the Las Virgenes Municipal Water District facility when one heard the thwomping approach of a large helicopter. After 20 seconds, a blue and white helicopter emerged from the clouds, passing from left to right, rolling to the left such that he caught a glimpse of its belly. It hit the hillside at 185 miles per hour. The tail and rotors broke off on impact and scattered, while the fuselage tumbled another 100 feet and burst into flames. The bikers hurried down the hill toward the crash. A circle of orange flames licked over the scattered debris. 9:48 a.m. Patty Taylor, the operations manager at OC Helicopters, sent out a group text. Land? The limo driver, waiting in Camarillo, replied, not yet. Taylor called her primary contact at Island Express, Vice President Baggy, and asked where Zubayan was on the flight tracking software. Checking the screen, Baggy saw that the helicopter had stopped tracking at 9:45 a.m. She told Taylor that she'd call her back and phoned Angel Perez, the ground operations manager. She told him to call Zubayan on the radio. Getting no response, Perez telephoned Camarillo Airport. No one answered. At 10:02, Rick Webb sent out a text to a group that included Zubayan and the limo driver waiting in Camarillo. Era, you okay? Baggy directed Perez to pull out the emergency response manual and start running the checklist. One of the company's other helicopters took off and headed for Zubayan's last known position. Meanwhile, in Calabasas, a flood of 911 calls had sent fire engines rolling to the edge of the water treatment facility below the crash site. As soon as firefighters climbed up the hillside to the wreckage, though, they saw that there were no lives left to save. Within 10 minutes, they realized who had died. 12:05 p.m. Amid social media speculation and false reports, TMZ broke the news. Kobe Bryant, daughter Gigi, die in helicopter crash. The following month, Vanessa Bryant filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Zubayan's estate, Island Express, and its parent company, Island Express Holding Corporation. Wrongful death lawsuits on behalf of John, Carrie, and Alyssa Altobelli, Sarah and Peyton Chester, and Christina Mauser have also been filed against Island Express. For its part, the helicopter company filed a lawsuit against two air traffic controllers who communicated with Zubayan that day, asserting that the crash was caused by their erroneous acts and/or omissions. For Dietz, who in addition to being a pilot, served as Island Express's safety manager until 2017, the tragedy of the crash is compounded by how easily it could have been avoided. If the weather's bad, you don't go. And half the time, the client's like, okay, thanks. whether they head for the backwater luxury of New Jersey, the towering gilt of Park Avenue, or a $30 million Florida plot, Jared and Ivanka will re-enter society as outcasts. MAGA Non Grata by Emily Jane Fox. Opening photo, Lord and Lady Loser. Friends predict that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump will face social scrutiny. They really don't care. Do you? And that is a reference to Melania's infamous jacket that she once wore with the phrase embellished. Something started to spread over the summer when Donald Trump turned the White House lawn into a venue for the Republican National Convention finale and potentially a living, breathing Hatch Act violation. The COVID-19 outbreak would come later at another White House celebration with scant mask and a misguided reliance on rapid test. What circulated first in text message exchanges from the Hamptons to Hollywood was a split second of footage taken as cameras panned the crowd. In it, viewers caught sight of friends of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, including Wendy Deng Murdoch and Tiku Mugrabi. Murdoch, a longtime intimate of the couple and Rupert's ex-wife, wore a red and white floral dress and a red face mask that blared MAGA across the mouth. Until then, the small group that remained friends with the president's daughter and son-in-law had largely done so in private. In October 2019, for instance, Jared and Ivanka hosted a group, including Murdoch and Mugrabi, oil heir Mikey Hess, and fashion designer Misha Nanu, a Meghan Markle bestie to boot, Lion Tree founder Arye Burkoff, the Trump siblings, and Josh Kushner, without his wife, supermodel entrepreneur Carly Kloss, at Camp David to celebrate their 10th wedding anniversary. Details about the celebrations leaked out, but the guest list remained guarded, at least from the public. Within their social circles, friends raised eyebrows and privately ridiculed those who had chosen to attend, according to several people familiar with the conversations. Kloss, conspicuously absent, was spared. Carly is the anti-Ivanka, a former friend of Ivanka's explained, independent, self-made, naturally beautiful, and truly authentic. When Jared and Ivanka traveled to Rome for Hess and Nanu's wedding weeks earlier, paparazzi circled as they sat outside the hotel for brunch or strolled the ancient streets, and guests would scurry out of frame so as not to be caught in photos with them, these people said. Those who have remained in frame, as one person puts it, serve as something of a cautionary tale. Among the set that Jared and Ivanka would prefer to rejoin, the one of Adriatic anchored yachts and Met Gala carpets, there is a sense of looking around for who, if anyone, will welcome them back. They were on these boats and in front of these step-and-repeats in the before times. Jared reigned over the New York Observer to buy himself into the world he wanted to occupy, and Ivanka wielded her power as a trustee, overseeing Murdoch's younger two daughters' fortune. But things have shifted. Now eyes are scanning for any hint of who will dress them, buy their real estate, seat them at the reserved table in their restaurants, educate their children, like their Instagram photos. Case in point, an article speculating that Ivanka would attempt to re-enter the New York art scene wound up in my inbox a dozen times. People familiar with the first daughter's art collection refer to it as unimpressive before COVID, but post-COVID, post-undeniable complicity, virtually unsalable. Or this, Over the last several years, a slew of sources have sent me a steady stream of screenshots showing mutual friends or well-known faces tapping like on an Ivanka Instagram post. Since the election, those people have started to post the screenshots on their own grams in full view. The hawkishness was no longer something reserved for secret sharing. They wanted their whole followings to know that they were watching. And while some of these people are crossing their fingers that Ivanka will fade to black, most of that crowd knows that while the Trumps may be leaving the White House, they will very much still exist. They will surely try to exert their influence. They will be a freight train, or a train wreck, steaming right through the hedgerow. From the jump, it was clear that the Trump administration's policies and actions would not sit well with many of the couple's former associates. An administration that kicked things off with a Muslim ban and merrily attempted to erase Obamacare and the Paris Accord, then moved right along to defend very fine people on both sides of white supremacy, erode faith in the state, and separate children from their families, was never going to fly with the image-conscious donor class company they once kept. That is to say nothing of how the administration handled the deadly outbreak. The callousness and cruelty that defined the Trump era and was so often the point turned almost all of their old friends away, or at least made it mortifying to be seen with them. But perhaps what precipitated the latest, greatest shift was that Jared and Ivanka became definitional losers, and they will soon be back on old turf. Elections, and certainly last year's, are reflection points. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? In the midst of a pandemic and national crisis, the questions carried more weight. For me, I've been able to take stock of how much has changed for the characters I spent much of the last 5 years covering. I remembered getting a phone call from Ivanka the week after her father won in 2016. The contents of the conversation were off the record, but my reporting around that time shows that, in her mind, she was shocked at the opportunity she now held and would have been foolish to pass it up. 6 months later, I traveled to Berlin to see her appear on stage next to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, then chair of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, and Queen Maxima of the Netherlands. I watched Ivanka survey her new cohort. The invitations she was suddenly receiving, though the audience booed her father's name, the motorcade that wailed through the city, and the throngs that followed her like she was a Kardashian with an ambassadorship. And it became clear that she would drink up every little drop of power, publicity, and access while the river flowed. In order to do that, amid the cruelties, controversies, investigations, impeachment, and scandal that punctuated her father's tenure in office, Ivanka had to draw her own universe, one divorced from the realities and horrors the rest of the world witnessed. If others in the White House were reacting to news of one of her father's former employees pleading guilty to federal crimes, for example, or his referring to African nations as shithole countries, Ivanka would post about some arbitrary meeting she'd taken, or a solo trip she'd made representing the administration, filled with professionally lit photos of herself and captioned without any acknowledgement of what was going on back on planet Earth. That tone deafness was not new for her. I've written time and again about her ability as a master compartmentalizer, a characterization she agrees with. She has forever been able to separate one piece of herself from another, her father's behavior from her continued need or desire to attach herself to him and seek his love and approval. Jared is like that, too. It's how, after his father Charles set up his brother-in-law with a prostitute, videotaped it, and sent it to his sister in an effort to keep them from cooperating with a federal investigation into his fraudulent campaign donations, Jared remained blindly loyal to his dad and the family business. This ability to separate parts of themselves and draw their own worlds was the key element that allowed them to survive in Washington over the last 4 years. It's also the trait that most angered the people who knew Jared and Ivanka before Trump ran for office. Most people cannot compartmentalize. They cannot separate Ivanka from the administration, despite what they thought of the couple or the individuals before all of this. And what will happen to Jared and Ivanka next is the question that vexes their old crowd. It's the one thing I've been asked most since the election, and the question I have, in turn, posed to all of the sources in their orbit, whom I've accumulated since I began reporting on them. The vast array of responses amounts to this. The couple will be accepted, whether in New York, North Jersey, or South Florida, by a combination of society-adjacent couples and real-deal Republicans, but not by the group of people to which they would like to belong, and not without social consequences for those who do choose to pal around with Ivanka. They'll be welcomed back by people who know the Trumps are as close as they'll get to power, one former friend told me, but everyone with self-respect, a career, morals, respect for democracy, or who doesn't want their friends to shame them both in private and public, will steer clear. As another longtime former acquaintance explained, they will probably be welcomed by real estate types and that group of Upper East Side and Palm Beach families that read about themselves in Quest magazine, but who don't matter. There will always be private dinner parties for them to attend, but they will be the entertainment, this person continued, meaning laughed at, not with. Ivanka is no Princess Margaret, and Jared is not the Duke of Windsor regaling guests with amusing bon mot to a captive audience. No one wants to hear about Sarah Huckabee's pies or Steve Bannon's shirts. The question of school for their three children looms, too. According to several people familiar with the situation, last fall, Jared and Ivanka's children switched out of the Jewish day school they'd attended since moving to D.C. There's some debate over what happened. Some parents say it's because the Trump Kushners weren't taking COVID safety seriously enough, particularly after the president's super-spreader hat trick around Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination last fall. A source close to the family says that the family believed it's best to put their kids into an in-person school rather than a hybrid virtual situation. Regardless of whether they move back to New York or to New Jersey or Florida, reactions from their fellow parents will likely be mixed. I personally can't imagine them going back to school in New York or New Jersey, but there are people in those communities who would freaking love it, a father of children in their former community told me. One mom says, from an Israel and a financial perspective, some parents there support Trump, and they want to be near power and extreme wealth. Or if it's Florida, a member of the Jewish community told me, those folks love Trump there. They'll have all their arms wide, wide open. Even their apartment building in Manhattan poses some threat. The couple has a place in a Trump building on Park Avenue. It just so happens to be the same building where Trump's former fixer Michael Cohen and his family still reside. It's been an uneasy situation for some time, as Cohen's daughter Samantha recounted to me last fall. For years, Ivanka had ignored her, despite their father's closeness, and despite Ivanka's own closeness with the elder Cohen. In 2018, a few months before Michael was sentenced, in part, because he paid off Stormy Daniels to keep quiet about her alleged affair with the now president ahead of the 2016 election at Trump's direction, Samantha ran into Ivanka outside of their building. She saw me, and I thought she was going to ignore me, as she had the rest of my life. But she grabbed my arm and said, "We all feel so terribly about what's happening to your dad. Our hearts are breaking for him. I'm so sorry that this happened to you guys," in this high-pitched, sugary voice, she told me. I knew how fake it was. I don't know if she was trying to make herself feel better, or if she did it for show, because there were other people in the lobby. It just felt like someone threw a bucket of slime on me because it was so phony and gross. When I asked Samantha about the potential that Ivanka and Jared could settle back in the building permanently and that they could run into each other all the time, she told me that the possibility would be beyond unpleasant and uncomfortable and completely awkward. She added how unfair it would be that they, who were involved in everything that's happened over the last several years, could come and go as they please while her father remains on house arrest in the same building. It is worth noting that their apartment is also just a scant block away from the home of Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, Melania Trump's former bestie, who wrote a tell-all about the inner workings of the Trumps and has cooperated in state and federal investigations that could implicate Ivanka and her family in potential wrongdoing. There is real estate reason to believe that Ivanka will not return to New York City permanently. The couple plunked down more than $30 million for a plot of land on a secluded Miami island known as the Billionaire Bunker, where the home is secure, the synagogue is a stone's throw, and the income taxes are just right. Add that to their plans to expand their cottage in Bedminster to include larger living quarters, two new bedrooms, a study, and a veranda. On the news, several sources messaged me, hopeful those sources themselves had done it, successfully scaring the pair out of a return to New York. A different longtime former friend countered that negative comments wouldn't even make Jared and Ivanka flinch. Narcissist, this person said, aren't self-reflective people who hear criticism and take it to heart. They turn that criticism around and find a way to blame the people who said it. The other favorite prediction circulating is that the couple has cottoned to the taste of political power, even if the ideological core of what Ivanka's father stands for is far from the one they've purported to care about. But Trump's reign has changed everyone, even the Trumps themselves. When Ivanka introduced her father on stage at the RNC over the summer, as she had 4 years earlier, she had hardened. She wasn't the so-called moderating influence that so many people had wanted her to be, but that was never her plan. She had been publicly criticized by the world she left behind, snubbed by world leaders who ignored her to her face, so there was no reason to cater to any of them anymore. Like her father, she was buoyed by the crowds at events, she keynoted. Those people in red hats who wait in line to see her, and there are many, are her people too. She is no longer the liberal outlier, privately issuing dissent. Father and daughter have become one and the same. According to a person still close to the couple, they haven't firmed up what's next. Should someone in the family choose to run, they have a significant hold on the Republican Party, potentially for many, many, many years, this person says. The same goes for the rest of her family, who see themselves as having a key role in the direction of the party, as something of kingmakers for what is to come. As a result of working in the White House, Jared has made international trade and peace deals. He's on good terms with people all across the world, and so the opportunities are significant. You can imagine the extent of his connections, the person said, pointing to what some have suspected all along, that Jared used his position in the White House to ensure a cozier life after the administration. Plus, this person added, Trump could be back in 2024. Then, all bets are off. That they even think their exposure to federal investigations could be curtailed by a pardon from Daddy, as was reported, is perhaps the ultimate rich kid affluenza. Regardless of where Jared and Ivanka settle, they'll never again find sincere acceptance among their old cliques. People will be nice to their faces. After all, it's called polite society for a reason, a former friend says. But people will be falling all over themselves the next day to say how awful they'd been and how they had no idea. Her father's vulgarity and his father's criminality will always loom too large. Growing Up, Ivanka, by Lisandra Orstrom. I met Ivanka Trump at an all-girls school on the Upper East Side, and we were inseparable for more than a decade. Gradually, though, our differences divided us. "Why would you tell me to read a book about effing poor people?" she once asked. And I watched her blow up her carefully curated image of refined privilege to embrace her father wholesale. Opening photo, flying high, teenage Ivanka Trump once dreamed of ruling Manhattan. Then her dad became president. And in the photo, she appears wearing shorts and a tank top on a rooftop terrace with a city skyline in the background. And she's smiling. Ivanka Trump was my best friend growing up. We first met when I joined her seventh grade class at Chapin, an all-girls school on Manhattan's Upper East Side that had a reputation for attracting a blue-blooded, feminine but ambitious cohort of young girls. After spending the previous 4 years in social isolation in the suburbs, I was eager to land on the popular side of the classroom, ruled by Ivanka and about five other entitled, precocious preteens. It was the grunge era, so we moshed around the classroom to the dystopian wails of Nirvana, wearing our uniforms of green plaid kilts, tailored shorter the more popular you got, and stacked heel Steve Madden loafers. By that time, most of us were allowed to roam freely around Manhattan above 57th Street before dark, and we rebelled by taking the subway to Patricia Fields in the Village, or dyeing our hair with blue manic panic from Ricky's. Some of us even went to Sheep Meadow to dye our hair green, the classroom code for a certain forbidden activity. Ivanka and I hung out occasionally at first. I got a last-minute invite to her 13th birthday party, where about 15 of us caravanned to Atlantic City in a trio of limos and camped out in the penthouse suite of the Taj Mahal for the weekend, supervised by two wary members of her dad's security team. She called me to pose in a photo spread for Sassy magazine because none of her usual group was available. I remember swinging by her dad's office at Trump Tower so she could borrow his credit card to go shopping. Though he never remembered my name, Mr. Trump seemed to have a photographic memory for changes in my body. I'll never forget the time Ivanka and I were having lunch with her brothers at Mar-a-Lago. And while Mr. Trump was saying hi, Don Jr. swiped half a grilled cheese sandwich off my plate. Ivanka scolded him, but Mr. Trump chimed in, "Don't worry, she doesn't need it. He's doing her a favor." Conversely, he'd usually congratulate me if I'd lost weight. Ivanka and I really bonded one summer when a group of Chapin girls went to Paris for a language program in what would be the first of many trips she and I took together. That July, we delighted in breaking the rules in harmless ways. When we took field trips into the city, we pretended to get lost on the metro and went to the movies on the Champs-Élysées or the Picasso Museum instead. Once, we all decided to wake up at dawn, sneak to London on the Eurostar for the day, and make it home in time for the 11 p.m. curfew. But everyone got scared and bailed, except for me, Ivanka, and one other girl. After that trip, Ivanka and I were inseparable. We remained that way for more than a decade, more sisters than best friends. Sure, she loved to talk about herself and was shamelessly vain, but she was also fun, loyal, and let's face it, pretty exciting. In our late teens and early 20s, it felt like Ivanka and I were always on the same page, or up for the same adventure, whether it was leaving Bungalow 8 early to watch a Lifetime movie, or horseback riding through a town in Nicaragua because we had never been there before. After college, we started moving on increasingly divergent tracks. I went to Beirut for my first reporting job, and Ivanka experimented with her own form of post-collegiate rebellion, commuting to Brooklyn for a job with real estate developer Forest City Ratner. Still, we remained close. Then, in 2009, shortly after I was one of two maids of honor in Ivanka's wedding, our friendship finally broke under the weight of our differences. It was easy to ignore the dozens of press inquiries that flooded my inbox when Donald Trump announced his candidacy, because I didn't think he would win. Then, when Ivanka joined her dad's administration, I was sure she would step in to moderate her father's most regressive tendencies, not out of moral commitment, but because caging children and ripping up climate agreements was a bad look in the halls of Davos. The Ivanka I knew painstakingly developed a polished intellectual offshoot of the Trump brand, blending the language and look of white millennial feminism with the mythical business acumen she claimed to have inherited. Her objective was always a more refined brand of celebrity than her dad's bombastic variety, the kind that allowed her to be graciously received by the B&T and Maidstone set and invite Blake Lively over for a girl's dinner, but also serve as an inspirational example of a woman who works. To the middle-class housewives to whom she peddled her fashion brand. Next photo, Boogie Nights. Ivanka and the author dancing in Paris to Going Back to Cali by Biggie. We danced to that a lot. Instead, I've watched as Ivanka has laid waste to the image she worked so hard to build. In private, I've had countless conversations with our childhood friends about how appalled we are that she didn't publicly oppose Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination, or most of her dad's especially repugnant policies. But in public, we've stayed silent, because that's what we are taught to do. I told myself my account wouldn't make a difference, because people had grown inured to the run-of-the-mill instances of misogyny, elitism, and poor character that I could recollect. In reality, I was afraid I'd lose friends and get skewered as a hypocritical elitist looking to capitalize on her Trump connection. My disgust with the Trumps was outweighed by my fear of being dragged through the mud. Even now, as self-proclaimed former friends vow that Ivanka can never show her face in Manhattan again, few of these detractors are quoted by name. A few months ago, after I voted early against her dad, I began to write about my friendship with Ivanka with no eye toward publication. But the more I wrote, the surer I became that I did not owe her my silence. I think it's past time that one of the many critics from Ivanka's childhood comes forward, if only to ensure that she really will never recover from the decision to tie her fate to her father's. As she's touted the achievements the Trump administration has made for the middle class, while not so covertly pursuing a massive wealth transfer to corporate America, I've been reminded of a phone call we had in our mid-20s. Ivanka always solicited book suggestions from me, and I had recently recommended Empire Falls, Richard Russo's 2001 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel about the life of a diner manager in working-class Maine. "Lai, why would you tell me to read a book about effing poor people?" I remember Ivanka saying. "What part of you thinks I would be interested in this?" Another memory that often occurs to me is of Mr. Trump delivering a toast to a room full of diners at Mar-a-Lago, who watched him as devotedly then as his red-capped followers do today. They laughed when he addressed them as the richest Jews in the world, complimented their luxury sports cars in the parking lot, and gleefully recounted the fight he was waging against the waspy club across the street, which he dismissed as a dump. Beneath the taunting, It was obvious that Mr. Trump was insecure. Back then, Palm Beach's old guard communities were among the few not seduced by his wealth. In contrast, it took no time for old money to embrace Ivanka. During summers in high school, she would usually come visit me in Newport, where I grew up in a WASPy beach community frequented by many of the same sort of people who patronized the club across from Mar-a-Lago. This set used to deride people like the Trumps, but Ivanka won everyone over. She was refined and fun to be around. She subscribed to The Atlantic and spoke about her lifelong dream of leaving her mark on the Manhattan skyline. After every conversation, strangers marveled at how she had turned out so unlike her parents. But in private, rougher, more Trumpian edges poked out. Ivanka regularly relayed stories of teachers or observers who commented that she had the most innate talent they'd ever seen for whatever new pursuit she was taking up. She never wore a Halloween costume that wasn't flattering, which means she usually showed up to costume parties looking beautiful and boring. She always stopped at McDonald's for cheeseburgers. She cursed. And, of course, she had the Trump radar for status, money, and power, and her dad's instinct to throw others under the bus. One of the earliest memories I have of Ivanka from before we were friends is when she blamed a fart on a classmate. Sometime later, she goaded me and a few other girls into flashing our breast out the window of our classroom in what was labeled the Flashing the Hot Dog Man incident. Ivanka had basically been the ringleader, but she pleaded her innocence to the headmistress and got off scot-free. The rest of us were suspended. While Ivanka laid the foundation for her conquest of Manhattan, I was experiencing a new reality in Lebanon as it was rocked by a string of political assassinations and a decimating war with Israel. The gulf between us became increasingly apparent. During my first 2-year stint in Beirut, Ivanka emailed me messages like, "When are you getting your ass back to NYC? You're going to be replaced." I remember her being the only person who didn't ask what the war was like. By the time I did return home, she had started dating Jared Kushner, whose family has personal and business ties to Israel, and my pro-Palestinian stance began to chafe. Since 2007, I've worn a necklace with my name written in Arabic, and Ivanka grew increasingly irritated by it. One night, in the middle of dinner, she glanced at the necklace and said, "How does your Jewish boyfriend feel when you are having sex and that necklace hits him in the face? How can you wear that thing? It just screams terrorist." But Ivanka was skilled at blunting her more Trumpian comments with equally typical acts of generosity. Once, she lent me her apartment for about 6 hours during a trip home from Lebanon so I could rendezvous with my boyfriend. She connected me with Peter Kaplan, the late editor of the New York Observer, who hired me as a freelance writer between 2007 and 2009. If I was single, she and Jared often tried to set me up with a roster of eligible bachelors in what I always felt was an effort to elevate me to the ranks of people they wanted to socialize with. When I was an intern at Al Jazeera English, I ended up on an awkward date with a close associate of Rupert Murdoch's. I sat through a group dinner while Jared, Wendy, Murdoch, and the New York Post, higher up, they had their eyes on for me, discussed the expendability of journalists in the digital age, and ignored me. Still, Ivanka asked me to be in her wedding party in 2009. The months between her engagement and wedding were a flurry of activity in which I was honored to participate. When I started a new job in a different field the day after their wedding, however, I expected my best friend, to ask how it was going. After what could have been days or weeks, I sent her a text that said something like, "Hey, I started a new job the day after your wedding, and you haven't asked a single question about it." Her reply was along the lines of, "Lie, I'm too busy for this shit." That was more or less the end. She still sent presents on my birthday and invited me to her Halloween birthday parties at Trump Soho, and there were a couple more group dinners. When my son was born, she sent me a gold-plated bracelet engraved with his name. We were both polite, but we no longer belonged to each other's inner circles. For the past 4 years, I have tried to tune out the conversation that dominated international media, but it is nearly impossible to ignore when this person who used to pluck ingrown hairs from your bikini line suddenly appoints herself an unelected public official and begins to torch democracy. When Ivanka posted a photo of herself on stage with her children at a Trump rally, I wondered aloud to another friend from the Manhattan private school world what her endgame might be. Ivanka deigned to dress middle American housewives when I knew her, but she did not pretend to want to hobnob with them. Predictably, as she began moving with the real power brokers of the world, Ivanka became increasingly certain that she and the rest of the capitalist elite had better solutions to the plight of America's struggling working class than elected officials. But aligning herself with her dad's Banana Republic-style administration made no sense to me until my friend suggested that Ivanka took her kids to the rally to show them that they are American royalty. This seemed most plausible. What is more royal than presiding over subjects that you disdain? I've been a good wasp and kept quiet until now, even as I've grown increasingly repulsed by Ivanka's ability to aid and abet her father. I've been comforted by the certainty that the backlash from those whose respect she craves most must sting. Still, I miss my old friend. I miss going to Green Kitchen on First Avenue at 1 a.m. for mozzarella, hailing down a boat in Amsterdam for a tour, belting out Anna Begins and songs from Les Mis on road trips. But most of all, I miss the time when the Trump family quest for power was not dangerous to the country. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.